We're going to do lunch. Open the committee, the Senate Committee on Healthcare for June 1st. And the first thing we're going to do is open a public hearing on House Bill 2300. Zena.
Thank you, Vice Chair Cruz. House Bill 2300A creates and specifies providers, methods, and criteria by which a healthcare practitioner may offer to treat patients who has a terminal illness with an investigational product that is not approved by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. It defines terminal disease and states that insurers are not required to reimburse any costs associated with the treatment. It specifies that hospice care must be determined on a patient's overall prognosis, care, or treatment goals. It specifies protections of waiver of liability for healthcare practitioners, healthcare facilities, and professional organizations or associations that comply with the measure. There's no amendment and no revenue impact and no fiscal impact.
Okay, I see a couple of esteemed colleagues from the House side. Would you like to come up and opine? Very strange mix there, don't you think?
No, not this session.
We're House healthcare teammates.
That's right. It seems that way, doesn't it?
I'm going to start and let my colleague do the heavy lifting. I'm State Representative Mitch Greenick, House District 33, and I'm delighted to be here to talk about this bill, which I think is a House Healthcare Committee bill. It really takes me back to in 2005, I was diagnosed with lymphoma, odd kind of lymphoma, mantle cell lymphoma, which I think my oncologist didn't have a very hopeful view of my prognosis at that time. I did, because I knew I was going to be fine. But the treatment options I was offered were three. One of them was a treatment that was a standard treatment for lymphoma, which I knew wouldn't help. And the other two were still in experimental. One was in a national trial that at that time had about 14 people already enrolled, going to 30. The other was in a trial that had about the same number, also going to about 30. And I was able to get them because there were other uses for them. They weren't completely experimental, but they were in phase two trial. I had to choose one, and I chose one, and it turned out I reacted very quickly to it, and I was in remission within 3 months, and have stayed in remission for about eight or 9 years now, with a couple of other treatments along the way just to make sure I stayed in remission. But those were drugs that in most circumstances wouldn't have been available. And what we're asking in this case is the opportunity for people with a prognosis of less than a year, and I'm sure my oncologist at that time would have certified that I had a prognosis of less than a year. Unfortunately, it turned out not to be true. And there's some argument now that the drug I took may actually have cured me rather than put me in remission, but that still remains to be seen. But when people are in that position, when they have a very short time to live, a relatively short time, and a year is a relatively short time, their option, and they don't have any really good options, they start looking for options that aren't so good. And basically what we're talking about here is options that aren't necessarily so good because these people have run out of options that are good. I was asked in an interview on the radio, well, was I worried about giving people false hope? And my response was, well, sometimes false hope is better than no hope at all. And that's what I think we're talking about here. So I would urge you to think about this very, very carefully. This is a serious situation. And I'll be happy to answer any questions on what I've said so far. But any serious questions need to be answered by my partner here.
Representative.
Thank you, Vice Chair Cruz, members of the committee. I'm Newt Bueller, representative of House District 54, which is most of the city of Bend, and I also here to speak on House Bill 2300, or sometimes known as the Right to Try Bill. I very much want to thank my colleague, Chair Greenlick, who has been just a pleasure to work with this session, and I think one of his first tasks was to give me the work group, along with Representative Nose, to bring all interested parties together to work on this, and I think you'll see the substantial amendments to the original legislation, which made this bill quite a bit better, in my opinion, and more thoroughly vetted than I think most versions across the country have been. The concept behind Right to Try is simple, but the results, I think, will be quite profound. It'll bring hope to hurting families, provide options to terminally ill patients, and certainly potentially save lives. Now, what really drives this is FDA approval process, which has been shown in national publications. There's an excellent review in the New England Journal of Medicine that the process for these drugs is very expensive and can take up to a decade to complete due to the rigorous testing standards. And it's very difficult for patients to obtain slots in these clinical trials. House Bill 2300 would allow terminally ill patients access to experimental treatments that are moving through this FDA process, remember, that can take up to a decade, but have not yet been approved for market. The treatment must have successfully completed phase one clinical trials, meaning that it still has potential and people are investing in the technology. And the patient must sign an informed consent, waiving liability for the doctors and the manufacturers. Now, I understand that there are some concerns with this bill, and rightly so. There's concerns that it will interfere with clinical trials, and as someone who's intimately involved in clinical trials in my past life as being a medical researcher, I can assure you with all confidence that this bill will not impact patient availability, overall findings, or other factors involved in these very important experimental clinical trial processes. Simply, it's alternative for people who desperately need these treatments to have hope. I also understand that in other areas there's concerns about the patient bearing a large amount of cost of these experimental treatments. And we talked about this in our work group, and we changed the legislation so that manufacturers may only charge for the cost of production of the drug, not marketing, not R&D cost. In addition, you have to remember that there's going to be a rigorous informed consent process between the patient and their provider to make sure they understand the implications of complications that may be associated with these treatments. And as a doctor, I can assure you that I believe there's nothing more important than protecting the lives of my patients and providing them with options. I cannot describe how difficult it is when you're taking some care of someone to tell them and their family, there is nothing else I can do to help you. Those are words that no doctor wants to say, and there are no words that any patient wants to hear. Further, I think Oregon has demonstrated in the past our leadership in healthcare innovation over the years through a number of efforts. This bill continues that tradition and shows that Oregon is a leader in new ideas and taking care of our most vulnerable citizens. I understand there are risks associated with experimental treatments. However, most of these families are simply out of options and just want the choice. I'd greatly appreciate you joining me in giving these patients the right to try. Thank you very much.
Questions for these people? Thank you very much. Shall we go ahead and have a session? Okay, I thought there'd be a lot more people. Thank you very much.
Sure, thank
no
you.
Questions here. Let's call, is it John Tui, Jessica Adamson, and Dennis McManny? Or Denise? Dennis.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jessica Adamson with Providence Health and Services. We are here today to register concerns with this bill, and I'd like to introduce Father John Tui, who is the director of our Center for Regional Ethics, to kind of talk more about the bill and Providence and our view on the importance of clinical trials and our concerns with this bill.
Thank you. Chair Mona's Anderson and members of the committee, as Jessica mentioned, for the record, my name is John Tui, and I'm the senior director of and hold the endowed chair in applied ethics in the Center for Ethics at Providence here in Portland, but serves for the whole system. So as you know, Providence certainly is a research leader, as are others in this area. Our centers of excellence, such as Cancer and Heart, participate in a variety of clinical trials to find new ways to improve patient care and to find cures for deadly diseases. And we recognize the importance of new drugs and devices and fully support efforts to improve patient access to clinical trials, as well as to access to experimental drugs outside of clinical trials through compassionate use. This compassionate use is based on research suggesting that there may be of benefit and overseen by the FDA, and also is overseen by local institutional review boards. Every use has to be reported in order to assure patient safety. And from 2010 to 2014, the last year for which we have information, fully 99.5% of all compassionate use requests sent to the FDA were approved for use. So that's non-clinical use for these patients. And in February of this year, the FDA announced that it wanted to streamline the process. And so we fully expect that the FDA will approve more and more quickly many of these requests for compassionate use. And Providence fully supports, and I see these, I'm on the Institutional Review Board, and I see these all the time, that the FDA regularly approves use of these unapproved drugs in non-clinical settings. We do have some numerous clinical and ethical concerns, one being that these drugs and devices only have to pass or be in, rather, phase one clinical trials for which there is little to no data of their efficacy or appropriateness. Phase one trials, the whole purpose of them is to find safe dosing so that there can be efficacy trials. So we don't have data on the efficacy. So we're taking a lot of risk with very little sense that there may actually be some benefit. And we believe in the ethical duty of non-maleficence not to put patients at risk without some reasonable hope that it will actually benefit them. And patients and families, of course, are always in a vulnerable state when they hear they're running out of options to manage their disease process and may in desperation find themselves willing to consent to interventions for which there really is not sufficient evidence to support even offering this in the first place. And we don't believe that patient autonomy in making choices is advanced in a context of lacking information. It should be informed consent. And when there's no information, how can we truly say it's consent? The bill would apply to children between the ages of 15 and 18, which puts tremendous pressure on parents who, of course, want to do all they can for their children. And we believe the current compassionate use process provides better clinical and emotional safety for all those involved. We believe there are some choices some parents should not have to make, like that between quality of time with their children and trying to extend that time at great risk. And finally, it puts clinicians who must practice with integrity in the very awkward and difficult position of making a judgment call themselves, which currently is made through FDA approval of a compassionate use by people who have much more evidence available to them and can better assess whether or not this unapproved drug should be used in this particular patient setting. It also can damage the therapeutic relationship because clinicians may truly believe that this is not the right way to go, and it puts them in a very awkward position with families demanding that this is the way they want to go. And disrupting these relationships at this vulnerable time serves no one's good, and the current FDA approval for compassionate use helps to avoid that. And there are serious financial concerns, particularly because these treatments and their adverse events that may be related to them can be extremely expensive, and especially because we're talking about phase one drugs, it's very difficult to know what adverse effects are actually associated with the drug or might be associated with advancing disease. And the presumption is likely to be, well, the drug caused it, therefore we won't pay for it. No one ever likes to believe there's nothing else that can be done to treat a disease and that the time has come to manage one's final days. And HB 2300A appears to provide another avenue to keep hope alive. It does so, however, we believe, without the proven safeguards to assure patient safety and clinically responsible options that are currently in place, and the evidence suggests works quite well. People who are vulnerable need protection from unrealistic and unsafe options as they are facing difficult decisions. The real justice issue of access to experimental drugs, we believe, and the evidence shows, is not with the terminally ill, but for the poor and minorities who rarely get the opportunity to even enlist in clinical trials, let alone have access to compassionate use. And we believe we should allow the new FDA process for compassionate use time to prove itself before opening the door to more non-scientific use of experimental drugs. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for coming. Question?
I would just say, Madam Chair, that had Father Tuohy not given his usual remarkable testimony, I had the privilege of working with Father Tuohy when I was doing my certificate in bioethics some years ago, and I could not agree more with every single thing he says. I share exactly the same concerns about this bill, and Father Tuohy articulated it perfectly. So thank you, Father. I appreciate
You're welcome.
It very much.
Thank you.
Senator, Vice Chair Moines, excuse me, Chair Moines Anderson, members of the committee. My name is Dennis McNanny. I'm with the Oregon Bioscience Association. There's not much really left to say. I checked off three of the items I was going to talk about. Frankly, one of them being the effectiveness of compassionate use in its current form and the fact that they're dramatically refining and improving that process. Prior to, I believe, 2 months ago, it would have taken a patient and a doctor maybe 100 hours to work through the upfront process with the FDA to initiate a compassionate use request. They've reduced that now to an hour. So it takes an hour for a doctor and a patient to work through the front end of that process. Now, I'm certain that it's still a number of weeks on the FDA side, but I would question how easy we want it to be for someone to get a drug that's only made it through phase one clinical trials, and we know something about its toxicity, but very little about its dosage or side effects. I checked off informed consent because, of course, not knowing those things, it makes it extraordinarily difficult to actually have informed consent. By the way, I didn't mention our association is neutral with concerns, and these are the concerns we've had all along. There has been changes to the original bill, which safeguard industry somewhat, but I'm not really sure that's what needs to be safeguarded in this particular case, as Father Tuohy presented. So I think our concerns are that this is happening in a rush in response to a problem that's already being solved. One of the latest bits of news is Johnson & Johnson recently opened an internal, I guess we'll call it a task force for the moment, but they're going to set up their own internal board because in prior years, it was sort of who you know to get into a program of any kind. And it's an unfair advantage for the people who are particularly well-connected. And I personally take calls fairly frequently because a friend of a friend of a friend knows I'm in the position I'm in. And I have to tell them I'm really not in a very good position to give them any advantage in this process. But really, I think the ultimate solution, if it is going to make care accessible to poor and more disadvantaged folks, that it shouldn't be those that can afford it or those that are better connected that can get into these. It really should be an ethicist and people who have expertise in the area deciding of the many requests which ones have the greatest odds of being clinically successful. So there's not much I can add other than I think the most important voice, and the New England Journal of Medicine article I think was passed around to everyone, dealt with the practical, legal, and ethical issues in expanded access to investigational drugs. It was published in January of this year, so it's very current. Of the three issues they dealt with, practical, legal, and ethical, I thought it was the ethical issues, frankly, that were the most compelling as we make these end-of-life decisions or help patients make them. So thank you very much for the time that you've allowed me to present, and I'll take any questions if there are any.
If I could say one
sure.
other thing.
Go ahead.
Mr. McNanny's point about the well-connected I think is actually valid, and we've seen this, frankly, and in a context that Providence, I think, has challenges with, which is Oregon's death with dignity law, which is to say that we know that many more people at least initiate inquiries about it than actually complete it, in part because it's a very complex process and because a lot of physicians are unwilling to be part of it. So you have to be able to have the resources to find someone. As a physician, if I were approached by a patient about this one, I would really struggle, and I would think it would put me in a pretty tough position to say no to one of my patients. But on the other hand, if I really thought it wasn't in the patient's best interest, I would be violating. I mean, I think I personally would be stuck between a rock and a hard place as a physician on this one to fulfill my oath that I took when I became a physician. I don't know. There's a whole host of reasons why, just to add on to that. There's also the therapeutic misconception problem that you have in research. So
thank you
anyway,
very much.
Sorry.
No problem. If you'd stick around, we're going to now have the proponents, Steve Buckstein and Kurt Altman.
Thank you, Chair Mona Sanderson and members of the committee. My name is Steve Buckstein. I'm Senior Policy Analyst and founder of Cascade Policy Institute in Portland, a think tank. I was also on the work group on this bill with Representative Bueller and Nose. You have my written testimony on OLIS, titled Right to Try is Right for Oregon, so I don't want to go over those details, but I wanted to briefly make several additional points. As some of you may recall, since Senator Steiner Hayward mentioned our death with dignity law, prior to that, there was a doctor named Jack Kevorkian who was very controversial. The first patient that he treated that he helped die in Michigan was an Oregonian. Her name was Janet Atkins in 1990. She was diagnosed with early, I guess it would be termed early onset Alzheimer's in 1990. I knew Janet. I worked with her husband, Ron. She taught English at Portland Community College. Again, she was only 54 years old when she got that diagnosis. And she decided on her own, with her family, that she wanted to end her life rather than risk, as she put it, losing her mind over the next few years. She made that decision, again, without telling a lot of people. It was not legal to do. Kevorkian ended up in prison. You know, we're trying to find better ways to deal with those situations. But when I first heard about the right to try concept last year, personally, the first thing I thought about, the first person I thought about was Janet and how she was a very intelligent woman. She made that decision. I think she was fully informed. Obviously, she knew the risks and made a terrible choice that she felt was appropriate to make. But if we'd had right to try, I can't help but think that she would have considered that. And she might not have found anything. We still haven't found a cure for Alzheimer's. But she might very well have had a different mission in her life and tried to find something, because with right to try, she would have been able to try to save her own life. And I think she would have been with us a lot longer than she was. Another friend of mine, who some of you may know, died 2 weeks ago today of terminal brain cancer. He was diagnosed in February, died 2 weeks ago Monday. His name was Bruce McCain. He was the chairman of the Reynolds School District, a legal expert, well-known, I think, in this building and in the Portland area. And again, I didn't talk to Bruce about this. It wasn't available. Even if there had been something that he might have been able to try, It wouldn't have helped. His situation happened very, very quickly. As you listened and you heard some well-intentioned testimony with concerns about this issue, about the right to try issue, and I recognize all those concerns. But let me tell you about the response to some of those concerns of one brave young man who came to this building on February 26th. He came to talk on the House side when this bill was being considered on the House side. His name is Diego Morris, and he lives in Arizona with his family. He and his mother, Pauline, came to Portland that day. I met them at the airport. And he came to lobby, this 14-year-old, in favor of House Bill 2300. Diego was diagnosed with osteosarcoma, bone cancer, a deadly form of bone cancer, when he was, I believe, 11 years old. And there was no known drug other than the standard chemotherapy and radiation, which probably wouldn't have helped him. But there was a drug that's approved in most of Europe, and his family found out about it through medical personnel, and they made the decision, and again, talking about who can afford things and who can't, they made the decision they could afford it. They moved their entire family to London for 9 months, and he went through both chemotherapy and radiation and this drug, which I can't pronounce. I've got it here, but it's approved in Europe. He's now in remission. Again, as Mitch Greenlich said, I don't know if it cured him or if it put him in remission, but he's alive today because they were able to make that choice that wasn't available because there was no right to try in Arizona or anywhere else. When he got to Oregon and he was interviewed by a number of media people, the one at the airport, his answer, she interviewed him, and she'd already talked to some of the opponents, including at least one of the people who just testified to you. She asked Diego, she said, what do you say to the opponents of right to try? They have, legitimate arguments, don't they, about why we shouldn't pass this law? And he looked up at her. He's only 14 years old. He looked up at her, and he said, quote, wait until they find themselves in my situation and then ask them. I thought that was pretty profound for a 14-year-old. And finally, Representative Greenlich mentioned that he was on a radio show and asked about false hope. I was on that show with him. We were both asked that question. What about the opponents say that this just gives patients, vulnerable patients, false hope? Frankly, I don't remember how I answered, but I remember how Mitch answered, and he said, as he mentioned here, sometimes false hope is better than no hope, and I agree with that. Diego Morris, the 14-year-old, had a somewhat different answer when asked that question. He said, there is no false hope. There's only hope. And what Diego wants you to know and what I want you to know, and I think everyone that supports this bill wants you to know, is that we need to give people hope. Again, there may be no cures, may end badly. It's guaranteed to end badly if they don't have this opportunity. And I just urge you to pass this bill and let people who are diagnosed with terminal illnesses at least have the option to try to save their own lives. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much. My name is Kurt Altman. I am the Director of National Affairs and Special Counsel at the Goldwater Institute in Phoenix. I am here as a proponent of the Right to Try Bill, HB 2300, as I'll give you a little background. I am one of the original drafters of the model legislation that HB 2300 is roughly modeled after, and many other bills and laws around the country. Currently, as we sit here today, I can tell you that Right to Try, the basics of Right to Try laws, just like HB 2300, are law now in 18 states and on four governors' desks, so essentially law in 22 states with many more running. What I wanted to do is really let this committee know that I've been around the country in most of those states and testified as to the intricacies of this bill. So I would be available, obviously, to answer any questions and urge you to ask me any questions or concerns you may have. But before we do that, I would like to address some of the concerns we heard from the Providence people, which are very legitimate concerns, and I will tell you are concerns that were accounted for and taken very seriously when drafting the model legislation. The first, and I've heard it in many places, there's a concern about clinical trials, that access to investigational drugs of this sort under Right to Try would damage clinical trials. But to the contrary, the incentive under Right to Try, and part of the reason it was drafted the way it was to preserve those clinical trials and actually make them an essential part of Right to Try. Father Tui talked about Phase 1 and drugs in Phase 1. Well, the fact is that this law, this bill, and the laws around the country don't allow access to drugs in Phase 1. They only allow access to drugs that have completed Phase 1 and, even more importantly, remain in clinical testing. So that means they're in Phase 2 or Phase 3 of the FDA approval process. The reality of the drugs that are actually accessed under compassionate use, which I will address in a moment, are drugs that are much further along in clinical trials, and often, as in the case that you just heard from Mr. Buckstein, and Diego Morris, are in use in other parts of the world. So to base an opposition on a premise that these drugs have no clinical testing and no real research or no real evidence behind them, I don't think would always be the case. And another safety mechanism, and this bill based on that very fact is that it isn't completely the decision. It isn't entirely the decision at all of the patient. Certainly the patient may wish to have drugs under investigation, believe they will help them. But Right to Try has been designed to take that physician and the treating physician into account. It has to be the appropriate medical decision. It has to be a medical decision of last resort. The one last chance, one last arrow in the quiver, so to speak. And HB 2300 has even a more significant protection. HB 2300 requires, unlike many of the laws around the country, although some do, requires a second physician's concurrence with the decision to administer this drug and that the patient is terminal. So those protections are certainly built in. The need for Right to Try is essential very much for to address the compassionate use problems. You heard earlier that 99% of compassionate use requests to the FDA are granted. That's an accurate statement. That's very accurate. However, there's only approximately 1,000 requests made per year to the FDA. That's compared to 450,000 people that die of cancer each year. Now, certainly each one of those people wouldn't be seeking compassionate use, but the numbers are minuscule. That's why states need to take the initiative and are taking the initiative to pass Right to Try laws. Compassionate use, you heard, is being fixed or sped up, but the reality of the way compassionate use currently works is it takes too much time. Patients that are terminal, they truly are in a situation where time is of the essence. There is no greater area where time is of the essence than for people looking for their last resort, their last opportunity to try to extend their lives. The current compassionate use system takes, as you heard, over 100 hours to fill out just the doctor-patient portion of the paperwork currently. That doesn't take into account the paperwork and the time it takes from the manufacturer side and then the amount of time the FDA takes to approve the process. It is true, in February of this year, the FDA proposed a rule. They proposed a rule to fix that 100-hour time frame. That fix is aimed only at the doctor-patient 100-hour side. And as you heard in earlier testimony, the proposed rule is to reduce that 100-hour time to 45 minutes, which really gives me a pause, because if it took 100 hours on a Thursday, let's say, and only 45 minutes on the next day, it clearly shouldn't have taken 100 hours in the first place. So we applaud the FDA for proposing that rule. However, it's only a proposal. It has not gone into effect yet. It is still only a proposed rule. We are on June 1st. That rule was proposed in February. How many months is that? I'm not good at math. I'm a lawyer. So that's, what, 4 or 5 months already. 4 or 5 months where they say they're going to speed up a process and haven't acted to do that. 4 or 5 months when people that are terminally ill need access or could potentially have access to drugs that might help them. The other thing about the FDA Compassionate Use Program and the proposed rule is it's a rule. The FDA could withdraw that rule if they ever implement it at any time. They could go back, and the time could take just as long as it does today, which on average, a compassionate use request that physicians are able to navigate, that manufacturers agree with, takes about 2 to 4 months currently. You'll hear the FDA say that they approve these in 24 hours over the phone. I've talked to hundreds of patients around the nation, and I've not yet found an example of one that was approved over the telephone. That's why Right to Try and access at this level between a doctor and a patient are so essential. The final thing that I'll address from the Providence folks was the financial cost. As the law or the bill indicates, companies may charge the direct cost for manufacturing of the dosage applied in this manner. That's no different than the current compassionate use program. They can charge under compassionate use as well. But the reality of the fact is, when companies provide medication outside clinical trials in a situation like this, where the patient is unable to access a clinical trial because they are either too sick or they aren't sick enough, As you may be aware, clinical trials only accept 3%, 3% of patients, approximately 3% of patients afflicted with whatever the condition may be. That means 97% of the folks are unable to access these medications. They aren't able to get in clinical trials. That's what Right to Try is designed for. So back to the financial costs, the reality is that these companies provide the majority of the time these medications for free under compassionate use for clinical trials and outside of the clinical trial situation. They don't have to, and this law doesn't mandate that they do that, because there are factors that go in to the provision of these medications, because while they're in clinical trials, manufacturers often have a low supply. They may not be able to supply the medication without some recoupment of costs so they can continue their other trials. I think those were the main concerns of the Providence folks. But, you know, Mr. Buckstein told you about Diego Morris, who I know very well, who had to go out of the country to access these drugs. What Right to Try will do will bring this access closer. Certainly it's not going to be perfect. Not every single person will be able to access these medications. But right now, the system is set up for those who have means. Only those people who have means can access these drugs. Now, you heard that. Only the Diego Morris families that can travel to London to live there for a year and be treated can access these drugs. Right to Try will bring access closer to people that need it more, back to the country where most of these drugs are actually researched, developed, and manufactured. I think that's all I have. I wanted to address those concerns. I'm certainly happy to answer any questions that this committee may have. I urge you to vote yes and pass this out of committee. Right to Try would help the people of Oregon, and I appreciate your time. Thanks.
If I may, thank you. Just to clarify, Diego Morris wouldn't have been eligible to use this law.
That's correct. Madam Chair, Senator Steiner Hayward, he would not. In Oregon, he was under the age of 15, so he would not have been able to do this. But Michaela Knapp, a 25-year-old Californian who had kidney cancer, who fought with the FDA for 4 months with her husband, Keith Knapp, to access an anti-PD-1 was the name of the drug.
Well,
she would have had access under this law.
Yeah.
She died, and 4 months later, that drug was approved by the FDA.
So, and if I may, Madam Chair, I think I want to just question one other thing you said, Mr. Buckstein. You know, you talked about a bad outcome and assuming that death is always a bad outcome. Well, it is in some senses, and certainly when we have young people die, and I've seen that happen all too often in my professional career. But I would challenge you that the only way to have a good outcome is to have access to these drugs in this way. I think that I've seen a lot of patients have very meaningful times with family and friends, doing things they want, having conversations that are important, young and old, in the last months of their life. And often those things don't even start to happen until patients recognize and families recognize that there are no other medical options, whether approved or clinical trials or whatever. And I think it's very important as a community that we have conversations about what the end of life looks like for people. And I think we have to be very careful about making sure that these patients don't end up with the wrong understanding. To try a drug that could have adverse effects when you don't even know if it actually has therapeutic, even the potential of therapeutic benefit, which we don't know until they're well into phase 3 trials. I co-chaired the IRB at OHSU for 4 years. I've been doing this stuff for a while. I'm really concerned by your assumptions here. And if you have comments that disagree with me, feel free. But I challenge that point about it's always a bad outcome to not have these drugs available.
Chairman Anderson, Senator Steiner Hayward, I didn't mean, if I said that it's always a bad outcome, I agree with you. There can be very good, I wouldn't call it a good outcome, I guess, but Oregon, I think, has led the way in finding these alternatives. I support, as I think you do, our Death with Dignity law. I supported, well, again, ever since Janet Atkins did what she did, I was thinking about it, and And I think, I guess I would say, I'm coming from a point of view, and Representative Greenlick and I come at this from a different, from different positions, but we respect each other's outcome, which is that basically the patient, I think, should have more choice in the matter when they do have a terminal illness. They may make the wrong choice from your standpoint. It may be, quote unquote, a bad outcome from their standpoint, but they deserve the right to try. And I think of all the options, for example, part of the work group that I think improved the bill was making the point in it, or adding the point to it, that trying an investigational drug does not make you ineligible for hospice. You know, those are things that I think we want to preserve. I'm not an expert as you are on these things, but again, when it comes to someone's own life, as Diego Morris said, you're right. He wouldn't have been eligible under the Oregon law. I think he should have been. That's an issue that, assuming this passes here, hopefully we can address the age issue at some other time. But basically, when you're faced with that diagnosis that you have a terminal disease, you should have more say in what your choices are, and this is one more choice that I think a lot of people want, and I know the system doesn't, and I think it's a matter of more individual choice, and that's where I come down.
Mr. Alton, do you have anything to say on that issue?
Madam Chair, thank you very much. I would only say that based on my experience and speaking with patients and patient groups, this isn't for everybody, and that's why everybody won't use it. Many patients, it is the best choice to go through palliative care, and that's what they want to do, end their life comfortably, build those relationships that we were talking about or that we were hearing about. But other people think differently. Other people want to fight for every day, want to see another sunset, want to walk their daughter down the aisle, whatever it may be. And this gives them that opportunity. And what the continuing theme that I've heard throughout the country is patients are looking for that control, the control between with them and their doctor to control how they live out the rest of their lives. And if that is trying everything possible, then that's what this law is built for. And again, it's not something that's not going through clinical trials. These are investigational new drugs that are in phase two or phase three of the FDA process and moving forward. If for whatever reason the drugs fall out of the process, whether they fail or a company simply stops putting them through for cost reasons or whatever, those drugs are no longer eligible. So these are, I can never come up with the right word, but they are legitimate investigational new drugs, and they're the same ones that people can request compassionate use for.
Thank you. All right, I would like to know, just put on the record regarding the liability. Who is liable? Is anyone liable? How does the bill take care of liability?
Thank you, Madam Chair. HB 2300 addresses liability by excluding or granting immunity essentially to manufacturers and medical professionals for the adverse effects of the investigational new drug. Now, what that doesn't mean is it doesn't grant doctors blanket immunity to commit malpractice. It doesn't reduce the standard of care of physicians. But if there is an adverse effect from the drug, the manufacturer will not be liable for that. Anybody in the medical line, physician, nurses, anybody in that treating line, will not be liable for that adverse effect. And that is in conjunction with the informed consent that will say something very similar for the patients.
And just to get back to the cost again, you said that a manufacturer may charge for the cost. Many times they offer it free, but it cannot be more than the actual cost of the manufacturer.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, that is correct. It cannot be more than the cost to the manufacturer. Not only by right to try, by HB 2300, which requires that. There is a federal law, 21 U.S.C. Section 331, prohibits any drug that has not completed the FDA approval process from being marketed or sold for a profit. But costs are allowed to be recouped.
Thank you. Are there any other questions from this committee? Very silent committee, except for one or two of us.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members
okay,
of the committee.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, I'm going to carry this bill over to Wednesday. And is that all we need to do with that? Thank you, everyone who's came to testify on this. And I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2300, open a work session on House Bill 2024A.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2024A directs the Oregon Health Authority, in consultation with coordinated care organizations and dental care organizations, to adopt rules and procedures relating to training and certification of health workers. There is a dash A3 amendment which replaces the measure and directs the Oregon Health Authority, in consultation with the coordinated care organizations and dental care organizations, to adopt rules and procedures relating to training and certification of health workers and their reimbursement. It specifies the rules for training, including instruction on performance of dental risk assessments and provision of oral disease prevention. It specifies that the rules require health workers to refer patients to dental providers and recommend patient visits at least once annually. There is no revenue impact, and a fiscal statement was issued.
Thank you. Is there someone here to talk on the A3s? It would be nice if maybe we could give a call to Lori Freeman, if that would be helpful, because she needs to be here on another one too. So while we're waiting, is there any discussion? We've already had a public hearing on this. Is there any concerns? I just wanted to make sure that the amendment, everyone is okay with the amendment. Is Joe Bell here? Or Deborah? Oh, there's Deborah. Do you want to come up, Deborah, to talk about the? I'm sorry, I didn't see you in the back.
Okay. Hi.
Tell me exactly what the dash threes do.
I don't have the bill in front of me, but I'll try to do it from memory. The dash threes had the traditional health worker reference be to defined by rule rather than calling out specific ones. It eliminated the provider type that's a new provider type under the ADA, the American Dental Association, that isn't a provider yet in our state. It also kind of massaged out, because there is a commission that oversees this particular group, and allowed OHA and that commission and the CCOs and the dental plans to sort of work on the rules that would be applicable to the traditional health workers being involved in oral hygiene and oral health instructions, and took them out of the direct service business. So they wouldn't be doing any direct patient type care. Their training would be more in line with what the scope of their duties are.
So who was involved in the formulation of the amendment then? Is everyone on board with that?
The last meeting I was at, the Oregon Dental Association was represented there, the Oregon Primary Care Association, Kelly Barnes was at that meeting, and OHA had two representatives at that meeting.
Okay, is there anyone out there that is opposed to the dash three amendments? Okay, thank you, Deborah.
Thanks.
Madam Chair, I move the dash A3 amendment into House Bill 2024A.
Senator Cruz moves the dash A3 amendments into House Bill 2024. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? It is adopted.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2024A as amended by the dash A3 amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 2024 to the floor with a due pass recommendation, or with the A3 amendments with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
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 Vice Chair Cruz?
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries, and I see that Senator Steiner Hayward is on this bill.
Certainly, I'd be happy to.
Okay, thank you. She will, Senator Steiner Hayward will carry the bill, and I will close the work session on House Bill 2024 and open a work session on House Bill 2306.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2306 grants explicit authority to the Oregon Health Authority to limit providers with regard to which medical assistance recipients may obtain prescription drugs if the recipient meets specific criteria. There is no amendment and no revenue impact and no fiscal impact.
Is there any discussion? We have the paperwork.
Could we refresh my memory as I'm pulling this up on what the meat of this bill does? And that could be directed to Zena.
It grants authority for OHA to limit providers with medical assistance to obtain prescription drugs.
It was trying to address the overutilization of certain patients. And so OHP clients, they would be designated a certain pharmacy under the PMP program, and then the medical, I can give you a copy of some of the explanations, but if you don't have it, it is in OLIS here.
Yep.
Thanks. It goes pretty carefully into what OHA may restrict certain fee. Now, these are fee-for-service clients to a designated retail pharmacy and a contracted mail order pharmacy due to suspected potential drug overutilization patterns.
Okay. All right. I think I'm good.
Madam Chair. I move House Bill 2306 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 2306 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator
Shields?
Aye.
Senator
Steinhaber?
Aye.
Senator Cruz?
Aye.
Chairwoman?
Aye. Motion carries, and Senator Cruz, would you carry this bill? Good. Senator Cruz will carry the bill.
About the pill?
Yeah. And I will close the work session on House Bill 2306 and open a work session on House Bill 2696A.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2696 defines delegated entities as dental care organizations, mental health organizations, or similar organizational providers. There's a dash A amendment, a dash A8 amendment, which replaces the measure and defines subcontractor. It requires Oregon Health Authority to conduct one external quality review of each coordinated care organization annually. It requires OHA to collect a standard list of documents collected from CCOs and subcontractors. It requires that when requesting information from CCOs on subcontractors, CCOs will be informed of documents on the standard list collected over the 12-month period. It prohibits requesting duplicative or redundant information. It creates requirements for contracted review organizations. It specifies that provisions do not apply to documents requested in the audit or fraud, waste, and abuse. There is a minimal fiscal impact and no revenue impact.
Great. And I'm not sure if anyone in the audience would like to come up and speak to this also, but in case we have questions for legislative counsel, I wanted to make sure that
anybody but him.
Well, yeah. Chairman Sanders, a member of the committee. For the record, Josh Pollock representing the Coalition for Healthy Oregon. I think Zena did a great job of explaining what the Dash 8 amendments did. I just want to thank Zena. Chairman Sanderson, Representative Nathanson, and everyone else who kind of came together to help make this happen, including the Oregon Health Authority. I think we've got a really good bill that will end up doing what we stated we want to do, which was reduce audits and make it so that we can really focus on helping our members and transforming the healthcare delivery system.
So the Dash 8 amendment specifically just reworded some things, or what?
Oh, I didn't.
No.
I'm sorry, I brought the wrong file.
Oh, well, we'll want you for that file, too. Okay. So, I don't have a problem with the A8s. If everybody's
Are you ready
okay.
for a motion?
Yes.
Okay. Madam Chair, I move to adopt the Dash A8 amendment and to House Bill 2696.
Senator Cruz moves to adopt the A8 amendments into House Bill 2696. Is there any discussion? Any opposition? It's adopted.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2696 as amended by the Dash 8 amendment to the floor to be passed recommendations.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 2696A with the A8 amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
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 Motion carries. Would someone like to carry this bill? Senator Knope will carry the bill. And I will close the work session on House Bill 2696 and then open a work session on House Bill 2638. Dana.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2638 expands the use of the Oregon Prescription Drug Program to include medical assistance recipients and coordinated care organizations. There's a Dash 4 amendment which authorizes the Oregon Health Authority to require prior authorization in accordance with federal law for a drug that has not been evaluated by the Pharmacy and Therapeutic Committee to determine if the drug has therapeutic advantage and has been 6 months or less after the United States Food and Drug Administration approves the drug for marketing. There's no revenue impact and a fiscal statement was issued.
Great. And I did want to put on the record that NAMI did write a testimony. They are all right with the Dash 1s as well as the Dash 4s. So what I'd like from you, Lori, Ms. Freeman, is to just explain the differences between the A1s and the A4s.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Lori Freeman from Office of Legislative Counsel. The A4 amendments, actually, I guess they're the Dash 4 amendments, address concerns that were raised by Jim Gardner about putting a six-month wait on coverage of bill of drugs after they've been approved for marketing by the FDA. And there is federal Medicaid law that says that if a manufacturer enters into a rebate agreement with HHS, Health and Human Services, that the state has to cover that drug in the Medicaid program. So having a flat six-month ban would violate those provisions of Medicaid. What the A4 does is it allows OHA to require prior authorization during that same six-month period, and it also changes the period. It originally was from 6 months from the date of marketing to the date it's prescribed, and this is 6 months from approved marketing to 6 months dispensed. It also preserves the carve-outs for mental health drugs, HIV drugs, et cetera. Those would not be subject to the prior authorization requirement. The A1 simply deletes everything I just explained to you.
Okay. So there basically there is no six-month wait.
Right.
We would not give Oregon Health Authority any wait period when a new drug comes up.
Madam Chair, that's correct. It just addresses allowing the medical assistance program to use the practitioner-managed prescription drug program.
Great. Thank you. Questions?
I would just make a comment. Mm-hmm. I appreciate Ms. Freeman's point about federal law, and if that's true, then the only one I'm going to be comfortable with is the Dash 4. I'm not going to be comfortable with the Dash 1 because I would want some kind of a prior authorization process as part of this for brand new drugs.
Senator Shields.
So for some time I've been asking kind of OHA to come forward and tell us what the likely effect of this bill is. Are they prepared to do that? Are they not going to do that today? That's okay. It's just that it seems like every time I meet with somebody in my office about what this bill does, I get a different answer. It sure would be nice to get a...
Is there someone from OHA that would want to... Yeah.
Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Trevor Douglas, the policy unit manager for Division of Medical Assistance Program. So I understand the question of is what exactly does Dash 4 do, or the entire thing?
Walk me through what I understand the prescription drug portion. Walk me through the second half of the bill and tell me what the bill does as is what it does with the dash one, what it does with the dash four.
Okay. So with dash four, it attempts, I think what my colleague here to my left, Lori Freeman, described, does do that, except it is unclear about new drugs and whether or not we can actually require a PA on specific types of new drugs. If I'm correct, the Section 2 and Section 4 are explicitly called out in the Dash 4 amendments, and they refer to specific things, legend drugs in the PDMP. So if they're, you know, on the PDMP or the preferred drug list, we'll call the preferred drug list for the sake of this discussion, makes it easier to say, we'd still be covering any of those things. The other thing is all of the other exceptions that have stood for as long as I've been around. And then four is mental health drugs. So if there's a new mental health drug, it would still have to be covered under dash four. And then with dash one, it's exactly what Lori said. It's going to be, none of this would be changed. It would just stay, it would stand status quo the way we handle things right now. And there is a new drug policy with respect to how we handle new drugs. They're just reviewed to make sure that they're on label and make sure that they're being used for an appropriate funded condition under the prioritized list.
Okay,
Chair, I'm yes. A little confused now.
I thought I understood, but now I don't think I do. So with the dash fours, that means that a drug for high blood pressure, it's a new drug, could require prior authorization, but a drug for a mental health issue or HIV or something else could not require a prior authorization? And is that what's required under federal law, or is that congruent with current carve-outs that we've done?
It's Senator Hayward, members of the committee, thank you. I would just want to clarify the federal law that we're talking about is the rebate law.
Okay.
And any drug that is approved by the FDA and the manufacturer has a rebate agreement, we, as the Medicaid agency, have to provide a pathway to coverage.
Okay. So, Madam Chair, then I'm going to regroup on what I said because I misunderstood. And this is a little confusing. I'm fine with having a prior authorization process because that allows us to be compliant with federal law. I have long been concerned about the carve-outs that we have. Not that I don't understand that there are very specific concerns related to mental health, HIV, other serious conditions, but because I don't think requiring a prior authorization, I've always been concerned about carving those out of the prior authorization process. I think it's bad policy, and I think it amounts to a kind of exceptionalism that I actually don't think is helpful to people with these medical conditions. And I include mental health in those medical conditions because it is one. I have real concerns about that. And if this is going to mean that this provides yet another carve out on that, not that I don't appreciate the concerns of people with all these conditions and the advocates for them. I do. Believe me, I do. But I've long been concerned about these carve outs, and I'm uncomfortable with if we're going to comply with federal law, then at least allow us to do this as a prior authorization. It's not that big a deal.
Well, this has been a political fight for a long time, and so we have stuck with the carve-outs because that's we would have constitutional issues if we did not provide the carve-outs. Is there any other comments?
If I could.
Senator Knope and then Senator Shields.
I do think with all of this. Oh, Senator Knope. Yes, sir.
Sorry. You're Shields.
Okay. He's Knope.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So what's wrong with the way we're currently doing things? Have you found it just to be unwieldy to the point where it's necessary? Because it seems like we're getting to the point where we're essentially trying to restrict drug use for patients who have significant issues.
Okay.
So the question is what's wrong with the way things are now?
So I think that it's important to understand that you're asking me for my opinion, first of all, I think. Is that true? I think that we have an opportunity in this state to understand what coordinated care truly is and understand where we want to aim with respect to the triple aim. And one of the things is good outcomes, well, better outcomes, and better care at a lower cost. And one of the most significant portions of our drug spend for medical assistance programs happens to be in the realm of these types of drugs, mental health drugs. And then understanding that we don't want to stop coverage of these drugs, but we want appropriate, safe use of these drugs. And that's what we're trying to do here.
And I think that with the Dash 4s, they would, the only difference really between the Dash 4s and the Dash 1s is it gives Oregon Health Authority a six-month window after a new drug is prescribed, except for the carve-outs.
Correct.
And when we had Sovaldi come in, it blew everyone away because the cost was what?
$80,000,
whereas in Egypt, what? It was $6,000 or anyway.
Substantially less.
And so what the Oregon Health Authority had to do was see how we could implement that drug. And they did. They worked out a system on how to implement that drug with our Medicaid population. This is not affecting commercial. This is affecting Medicaid, correct? Yes. And so that's why we were wanting to give them window, because usually the P&T committees, once a new drug is out, they will have their information on how to implement the drugs fairly quickly, as I understand. But it's for the big drugs that have such a tremendous impact.
But if I may, Madam Chair, I'm sorry, Senator Shields, you were waiting. I apologize. I'll come in later.
I understand how this meets one of the triple aims. I don't understand how this provides better care. Can you help me?
So we want to make sure that anything that is prescribed is appropriate and safe. And we want to make sure that there's also all the options are considered. And oftentimes there's lower cost alternatives that haven't been tried that should be tried before some of the more expensive options are on the table to be considered. There's a number of things, other things that escape my mind at the moment, but from a clinical perspective, there's also other things that we consider and are developed as part of the PA criteria that the P&T committee, that is staffed by much smarter people than myself, create.
Can I ask one follow-up? So, I mean, when these blockbuster drugs are coming down the pike, you know they're coming down the pike. It's not like all of a sudden you get an email, oh, shoot, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
What's happening? And it just seems like all this is about is cutting costs, which I can appreciate, but it seems like you could gather the P&T committee and get to work pretty quick, and you wouldn't have to deny a prescriber, a provider, and their patient these type of potentially significant drugs.
So I want to be clear. I don't think that we're claiming to deny someone those particular new blockbuster drugs. I think it's important to clarify that there would be steps put in place for them to engage first, and there would be a robust PA criteria of some form that would be developed by clinicians and experts in the field from the P&T committee. It wouldn't be blocking the new drug necessarily.
May I add a comment? I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. I don't see that in the bill. You're saying that that would happen in the rulemaking process?
No, the P&T committee is the one that develops PA criteria and would be the ones that would be – you asked what the P&T committee would be doing and how – and what would they do to curtail the use of that particular agent. They're going to focus on what the evidence says. Then they're going to develop the clinical criteria that would make it an appropriate agent to utilize over other lower cost or other equally effective, maybe equal cost agents.
Madam Chair, if I may, a couple things. The first thing is, while I appreciate Senator Shields' concerns, I would point out that this is exactly what happens for any of us with commercial insurance. A blockbuster drug, a new drug comes out, it is not automatically available to people with commercial insurance either. I would also point out that it often happens that despite hopefully rigorous clinical trials, adverse effects that haven't been documented because it hasn't been out in wide enough use come up in the first 6, 12, 18 months that a product's on the market. So, and finally, just the fact that a drug is new doesn't make it a better drug. There was a long period of time when the international recommendation for the first-line drug treatment for hypertension was a drug that had been on the market for 50 years. And cost $4 a month, and it was the first-line drug that we used for almost everybody. Recommendations have changed because the evidence has changed, but the new drug that they recommend is just as cheap now because it's been on the market a while. So, yes, there are conditions that are resistant. And the point about the Hep C drug actually makes my point, if I may, Madam Chair, not to be disrespectful, but in exactly the way. Hepatitis C is a very serious disease. And it has significant adverse effects, just as mental health issues do, just as HIV/AIDS does, just as cancer does. And yet we have agreed as a state to allow our P&T process, to allow the Health Evidence Review Commission to do its work and develop a protocol that has not been without controversy. But we have accepted this process in this state for 25 years now, over 25 years. And I really worry that we end up saying that certain diseases are different or more worthy of getting treatment at a certain time than others. I'm sounding like a real ogre today, I gotta say. I mean, I'm coming across as, I don't want people to have access to experimental drugs. I don't want have people with mental health or HIV/AIDS or cancer to have access to new drugs. That's not my point at all. I think that a prior authorization process does allow access to these drugs, the new drugs that are available, and I really can't imagine a CCO in its right mind that if it was really clear that a brand new drug that had been approved 3 days ago was the right drug for a patient wouldn't figure out a way to approve it. I mean, they're not ogres. And I think this does – I'm sorry. I don't even know
Ms. Freeman, you had a comment.
Yeah, I did want to address a few of the things, and I'm trying to keep them in my mind. I'm going to address Senator Steiner-Hewitt's last statement first. Oh, by the way, Lori Freeman. Legislative Council. This statute that's amended only applies to fee-for-service. It doesn't apply to CCOs. And I don't know why that is. It's because that's what the OHA says. And then I also wanted to say that the amendments in A4, they only allow the prior authorization for the longer of 6 months after marketing or until the P&T committee has a chance to review the drug. So if the P&T committee reviews the drug within a month and comes up with, you know, recommendations, then they would have to abide by those recommendations. And then there was another thing that I forgot now.
Okay. Yes, Senator Cruz.
What's the assumed savings?
Senator Cruz, I apologize. I'd have to get back to you on that.
I mean, the only way to even consider going here is you're going to save a boatload of money, which I think is not true. Number one, the fee-for-service population is quite small. And number two, these are extraordinary circumstances. So, I can't think of any other reason to change what's currently being done unless we're going to save money.
Madam Chair, did you want to move the bill today?
No, it's going to be carried over. Just wanted to know.
But if you know, I understand we're talking estimates here, but if there's a ballpark, that might be helpful.
We'll get back to you.
Okay.
All right. Thank you very much. With that, I will. Any other comments from anybody? All right. We will close the work session on House Bill 2638 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2466.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2466A aligns Oregon statutes with the Affordable Care Act for compliance relating to health benefit plans. There is a dash A3 amendment which directs DCBS to adopt rules to determine if an employee is an eligible employee and an employer isn't a small employer. It requires a method to be consistent with federal requirements for the Small Business Health Options Program. There's a dash A6 amendment, which broadens the definition of transitional large employer benefit plans to transitional health benefit plans. It allows transitional health benefit plans to be renewable on and after 2016 and allows the directors to subject plans to rate review by rule. It requires a report to the Legislative Assembly in 2018 and provides a 2020 sunset date. It allows transitional health benefit plans to not be excluded from renewal if the plan is discontinued if it meets certain requirements. It requires small employers to be offered all health benefit plans. It restores subscriber contract and definition of health benefit plans. It clarifies that grandfathered health benefit plans are excluded from specific minimum benefit requirements. It restores and modifies language related to data and reporting. It clarifies when insureds may not offer plans and modifies operative dates and restores eligibility requirements for coverage of hearing aids. There's a dash A7 amendment which requires DCBS to exclude transitional health plans. It modifies the definition of small employer to permit deviation if the federal government develops regulations. It restores the subscriber contract and definition of health benefit plans. It clarifies that grandfathered health benefit plans are excluded from specific minimum benefit requirements. It restores and modifies language related to data and reporting. It clarifies when insurers may not offer plans and modifies operative dates and restores eligibility requirements for coverage of hearing aids. There's no revenue impact and no fiscal impact.
Great. All right, Laura Kelly, and then let's bring up a panel here. We've got Tom Holt and Jessica Adamson. Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good afternoon, Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Laura Kelly. I'm the Insurance Commissioner with the Department of Consumer and Business Services. And today I'm here to talk to you about House Bill 2466, the A engrossed version, and also to speak to a number of the amendments that are before you. The bill was originally proposed by the department to make technical changes as described before to align Oregon law with federal law and address a couple of issues that came up since the last time we were we presented an ACA alignment bill in the 2013 session. One of the major pieces, which is where I'm going to focus most of my discussion today, is a policy issue that was not in the original bill, and we had not originally intended it to be in the original bill. But while the bill was on the House side, an issue concerning the small group market and a transition that's occurring in 2016, you really created a lot of discussion within the health insurance community, and the department came forward and proposed an amendment that is contained in the A engrossed version and further adjusted in some of the other amendments. And so I want to talk to you a little bit more in detail about that. The A engrossed version of the bill that you have in front of you includes the includes mostly proposed technical changes, and there are some further adjustments in the A2 amendments that also just clarify some technical details. And just to give a couple of examples, I know that many of them were discussed before. The engrossed version of the bill does things like prohibiting group health benefit plans from varying coverage or cost for late enrollees based on health status, just clarifying that that is not something that's allowed. Eliminates the existing 90-day waiting period for individual health benefit plans, and it clarifies that coordination of benefit benefits applies for both large group and small groups, and that's something that we were just making sure was underscored in the law. I want to focus most of my comments on the small group issue. There is a key policy issue that we're proposing to address with this bill. Currently, Oregon law and federal law defines a small employer group as an employer with 1 to 50 employees. Beginning on January 1st of 2016, that definition changes both in federal law and Oregon law, and it moves to 1 to 100 employees. And the intent was to create a larger, more stable risk pool going forward. And this may be true in the long run, but we are concerned about some instability that can create in the short run. And there are a couple of reasons why we're concerned about that. The major risk has to do with a difference between the way small groups and large groups are rated, the way the premiums are determined. So as we sit today, the 1 to 50 groups are considered small groups. The 51 to 100 groups that would become small groups, but today they're considered large groups. And under current Oregon law, a small group is rated on what we call a modified community rated basis. And so it's kind of an average pooled rate. Each employer doesn't pay a different rate depending on its own employees' claims costs. It's really based on the entire small group pool in the state. And there are only some very specific adjustments to the rates that can be made. And it relates to the age of their employees, where they live in the state, and whether they use tobacco or not. That's very different than what occurs in the large group market. The large group market, the rates actually reflect the risk of the underlying group. So if you have an employer group that has 51 to 100 employees and they have higher than average claims costs, their rates will reflect that. They'll be higher than kind of an average large group rate. And conversely, if you have a group of that size who has lower than average claims costs, they'll have a lower rate than average. And so with the definition expanding in 2016, those groups of 51 to 100 will now be rated like a small group. So those that had the higher claims costs and the higher rates will move toward the middle and see lower rates. The groups with the lower claims costs and the lower rates will move toward a higher rate, and it really kind of moving everybody to the market average. And that was the intent of the expansion. There is, however, a very real risk that we're concerned about. Because time is running short and there hasn't been a lot of time, I think, to plan and analyze and communicate with employers and employees about the impending change, we're concerned that those groups, the 51 to 100 groups with less or lower than average claims costs, they're going to see their rates increase, some of them significantly in 2016. And those that have the ability to self-insure will likely consider doing so. And that can be very disruptive to this new small group market. That is, we're actually trying to gain stability, and creating a disruption like this could actually take that in the opposite direction. What we're proposing to do is to give a little bit more time to fully analyze and understand what the ramifications of that expansion are going to be able to better communicate with employers about what the impact of the transition, expansion is going to be, and to consider whether there are any ways to kind of, you know, really transition this over more of a period of time so that we don't see a flight of those lower claims cost groups to self-insurance. Our concern is that with self-insurance, if a group decides to go that route, it's often not for just 1 year. It might be a longer lasting and potentially permanent decision. And so that could affect that small group risk pool on a more permanent basis.
Question. So really it would behoove an industry for wanting to self-insure if their rates were going to go up 50 to 90%.
Chair Monis Anderson, that's correct. So if you have a group who had lower rates and sees a large rate increase, they might decide it's more cost-effective to self-insure.
So what this time frame, what this bill would allow then for you to try to mitigate the increased costs that some might be seeing so that they don't flee the system?
Yeah, Chair Monis Anderson, we're proposing really kind of two options, because there's an unknown in all of this too. Currently, the federal government is actually looking at this issue. There's a bill in both chambers of Congress that's been introduced. I don't know, you know, what kind of the ETA is on it, but the proposal is to allow states the flexibility to delay that expansion if they so choose. And so that's under consideration. There's been some discussion, within the Department of Health and Human Services about considering options to give some more flexibility flexibility. If that flexibility is granted, what we propose to do in the bill is to take advantage of that flexibility and be able to delay expansion. And so that would just give us more time and not take expansion off the table, but to delay it for a short period of time for us to better plan and consider whether there are ways to mitigate that. And so that's the option if there is action at the federal level. If not, if the definition stays as it is and it expands to 100, we're proposing to allow the transitional plans, which are the plans that people were able to keep at the end of 2013 if they wanted to keep their plans, allow those to continue through their last renewal, which can't happen after October 1st of 2016. So it's about giving some more time for analysis and planning and potential identification of mitigation measures. But we're concerned about having really the ability to have a longer dialogue and to be able to make sure that we don't see some knee-jerk reactions just based on price.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the difference is between January 2016 and October 2016. Did I hear you right?
Chair Monis-Anderson, Senator Shields. So yes, that's correct in the situation where we're talking about the transitional plans. And it's it's a little bit nuanced in the sense that if you were a group that, let's say your renewal date was July 1st, so you could renew your plan on July 1st, 2016 and stay on it through the end of June in 2017. You could do kind of the same thing today. I guess you could renew right up until the end of 2015 and stay on your plan through 2016 if we didn't do the transitional plans. But it is a relatively small difference in terms of the time. But we think it is important to give us more time to discuss and to make sure that everybody, you know, fully understands how this will play out. Okay. Chairman, if I may, I have just a couple of minor things to mention. I did want to mention that already under Senate Bill 1582 that was passed last session, small groups, the 1 to 50, have already been allowed to have transitional plans, and DCBS was granted rulemaking authority to consider extending that, and we have extended that for 2016. And so we're also concerned about potentially creating a different treatment for the 51 to 100 groups and the 1 to 50 groups. I think that is potentially concerning. This is not an issue that's unique to Oregon, and this is something that other state regulators have expressed concern about. And there's actually been a policy paper issued by the American Academy of Actuaries expressing concern about expressing just the fact that self-insurance could result in selection and potentially raise rates for the small group market. So I just want to highlight that this isn't really unique to our state. I've talked a lot about the small group issue, and I just want to mention, I know that there are a number of concerns with the fact that this could mean the groups with the lower experience will keep their plans and they won't move into the new small group market. And I understand that concern and I appreciate that concern. I do think, however, that the risk on the of self-insurance could be a more long-lasting and potentially permanent concern that could have a similarly disruptive effect.
So the co-ops who really don't want the extension for large groups, that's their main concern?
Chair Monis-Anderson, I believe so, but I won't speak for them to articulate their concern, and I believe that someone's here probably to discuss that. I did want to mention a couple of quick things on the amendments. So the A2 amendments were amendments drafted at the request of DCBS, and they included technical changes just to make sure that everything was worded just correctly. There are A3 amendments that discuss the small group definition, and we are comfortable with the A3 amendments. There is also an A6 amendment, and my understanding is the A6 amendment includes the A2 amendments that were requested by DCBS, but it also includes an adjustment to the hearing aid mandate that we have no concerns with at this point. So we are comfortable with the A6 and the A3 amendments, but the A7 amendments deal with the transitional plan issue that I've expressed concern with, and so we are not comfortable with those at this point. I'm happy to answer any questions that the committee may have, and thank you. Thank you for letting me have a chance to talk about this, and also thank you to Legislative Council, who's been extremely helpful to us through this.
It's been a journey.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jessica Adamson here with Providence Health and Services. We are here today in strong support of the A6 amendments. The A6 amendments, as Commissioner Kelly indicated, are the A2s, and they include all of the small group transitional components, of which we share the division's opinion are very important in this time of great change. But they also do address restoration of the current hearing aid mandate. So the Dash 2 amendments would have resulted in an expansion of that mandate. As you may recall, in 2009, this mandate was passed, and on legislative record was that this mandate would apply to children below the age of 18 or under the age of 25 if they were still in school, because the purpose of that mandate was to enable kids to be able to hear their teachers. And so if you're in college or you're in school, my children who are in high school and in those ages don't always listen to me, but I think that has to be me with their being their parent. Very important for kids to be able to hear their teachers. The A2 amendment expanded that because there was a belief that that may have been required by the ACA. We took a close look at that in connection with the division, and we really appreciate Jeanette Holman and Commissioner Kelly and all of their work with us as we looked at that. We do not believe that that was necessary for two reasons. One, the existing language doesn't violate the ACA's non-age discrimination provision because the ACA contains an exception for valid statutory objectives adopted by state legislatures. And that's in 45 CFR 91.13. In other words, the federal government did allow state legislatures, and they acknowledged that they may have good reason to differentiate requirements based on age and built deference to the states into the law. In this case, the Oregon legislature said it's important for kids to have access to hearing aids, so we're going to pass this mandate for kids, and that's allowed. The second, the ACA's age non-discrimination provision only applies to individual and small group plans through the essential health benefits requirement. The amendments in the A2 would apply more broadly to large group plans and therefore overbroad if the intention was to align with the ACA requirements. It's important to note that the A2, as it relates to this specific mandate, would have had a pretty dramatic impact on premiums, as commercial plans, as a general matter, do not cover hearing aids except as provided for in this mandate, and Medicare does not cover hearing aids. So while there may be an important or an opportunity to have a debate upon whether or not this is an important mandate to expand, in the context of ACA alignment, we did not believe that that was necessary. And again, the great work with the division in identifying this opportunity to differentiate based upon state legislature's prerogative, we believe enables the current statute to stand, and the A6 amendment, again, includes everything in the A2 and restores the mandate as currently written.
Tom.
Chair Miles Anderson, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Tom Holt with Cambia Health Solutions, here in support of House Bill 2466 with the A3 and A6 amendments. First off, I want to thank Commissioner Kelly for having a very open and extensive process in developing the underlying bill over the last several months, and then the what became the A2 amendments. I won't go into excessive detail. You've heard great explanations of what the A6 now does, but I just want to hit on a couple of key points. One, you've had in this committee Senate bills 145 and 146 dealing with flexibility. One was dealing with flexibility for small groups, and the other was dealing with an old definition in Oregon law that to be a small group in Oregon, you have to have a majority of your employees in state, and 146 says good enough to be headquartered here. 2466 with the amendments fixes both of those issues, and so we're very happy about that. The other issue thing I'd point out here in regard to these transitional plans for the employers of 51 to 100 employees, Commissioner Kelly is absolutely correct. This is not a problem unique to Oregon. Actuaries nationally have been publishing about this and talking about it. It's an issue of great concern. There was a good article in one of the major newspapers just this last week that noted, I think, close to a couple dozen states now have gone down the road of providing some extra flexibility and time to figure this out. So we would not be alone in having that ability to just see how things play out. We think that would be prudent, and so we're not supportive of the A7s. The concern about groups electing to go self-insured is not an idle one. I can tell you just based on the level and number of inquiries that we are getting from current customers about going self-insured who are at the smaller end of the large group market, that is a very real possibility that groups would elect to go self-insured rather than get what would most likely be very, very, I can only describe as eye-popping rate differences going immediately into small groups. So we think the prudent thing to do would be to do what's called for here in the A2s and the A6s, which we support.
I mean the A3s.
The A2s were the kind of rewrite. A3s were dealing with how you count small group.
But A2s.
And A6 is now, I think, what we're talking about.
A3 and A6.
Sorry.
A6 includes the A2s.
Yeah, yes. A6 includes
so
the A2s. A2s. Sorry.
So it'd be A3s. Too many A's. And A6s. Yeah, not the A2s.
But anyway, I think it's a prudent step for us to take, and what it's doing is allowing Oregon to move with the rest of the country per federal guidance.
Thank you. All right, Jeremy Vandehey.
Madam Chair, can I ask a question?
Oh, yeah. Okay. Real quick? We're running late now.
Yeah. So something jumped out at me at Health Republic's testimony, Commissioner Colley. It said that kind of the more established carriers will have the ability to cherry pick the groups they wish to keep through premium rate increases. So will the carriers have flexibility on shifting, staying in large or going small with their customers, or would everybody have to stay where they are until we get to October 2016?
So, Chair Monis-Anderson, Senator Shields, so right now, you know, it's written as giving DCBS the, you know, rulemaking authority to allow transitional plans. And so the way that that's happened in the past is each individual insurance company has decided whether they were going to offer them as a whole, and what they had to do is if they offered the transitional plan, they had to offer it to any of their customers who qualified. So it was the customer's decision whether to stay on the transitional plan or not. The insurer could not just offer it to one and not offer it to the other. But, you know, as I understand the concern, I think it may have more to do with the fact that large groups are rated in a more individualized fashion. And, you know, we don't have regulatory authority over large group rates, and I just should be clear to remind the committee of that. We do for small group. But, you know, they are typically based on, you know, an actuarial analysis of the underlying claims for that group. And, you know, that the rate is certainly going to be a factor in those companies' decisions about whether to stay on their plan or not. And that's exactly the concern in reverse for the self-insured piece. And so I think I think it's a valid concern on both sides. But I think that, again, the concern about going to self-insurance, I think, is a potentially longer lasting and more permanent issue.
All right. All right, Jeremy Vandehey, is it Michael Stratton or Michelle?
Michael.
And Betsy Earls.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jeremy Vandehey with Kaiser Permanente. I know you're running out of time, so I'll be very brief. Kaiser supports the bill with the Dash A3s and the Dash A6s. I want to thank the Insurance Division for all their work on this. Commissioner Kelly, Jeanette Holman have done a tremendous amount of work digging through the details on this. This is like the fourth go-round of technical alignment with the ACA, probably not going to be the last one, but hopefully the last major one. Just briefly, the Dash A3s were an amendment that we brought forward, and it just deals with making sure there's a uniform counting method for how you actually count the number of employees to see if it's up to 50 or up to 100.
different states do this in different ways. The feds have put out their own guidance, and so this will just ensure that there's one uniform method across the entire small group market in and out of the shop. Thanks.
Great. Mr. Stratton?
Chairman is Anderson and committee members. I'm Michael Stratton. I'm a principal with ISU, the Stratton Agency, Stratton Insurance Services Incorporated. We have offices over in Pendleton, Oregon, Hermiston, Oregon, LeGrand, Oregon, and Elgin, Oregon. I drove here today. I got to be at Enterprise for my first appointment 9 a.m. tomorrow morning, so it's going to be a long day. I am a certified insurance counselor as well as a certified financial planner. I've been in the insurance financial services business for 31 years. We have over 4,000 clients in our agencies over in Northeast Oregon. I spent 55 years out there in the rest of Oregon. I was born not too far from here in the Willamette Valley a long time ago. We currently represent over 120 Oregon businesses that we have insurance placed through either the small group market or the large group market. And it's been a big part of our business for many, many years. We do a lot of other things for these clients too. But I've been at this business a long time, and I'm passionate about taking care of my clients. I was pretty apprehensive about the Affordable Care Act, just like a lot of other people were as we went through this. Honestly, last year, we were able to work within, and we have virtually all the groups that we do business with have been brought into compliance and have Affordable Care Act compliant plans. We can sit here and scream about the bad things, but there were a lot of good things that were a part of the Affordable Care Act. We actually have a number of groups, because of the Affordable Care Act, were actually able for the first time to implement group plans for their employees. So there have been a lot of positive things that have happened. I've been at this a long time. Some of you probably don't know all the history, and I may get the hook here if you do grab me. But I was around in Oregon writing health insurance in the late 80s, early 90s, before small group reform that took place in the mid-1990s. When you have three small groups get renewal from one carrier a given month, and one of them gets a 30% increase, and one of them gets a 0% increase, and one of them gets somewhere in between, you get pretty frustrated, particularly when the carriers told you they don't experience rate small groups. Then the story became, well, we don't just experience rate small groups. Bottom line, folks, was small group health care reform 94, 95, 96 fixed this. We got small group pools put in place and then went about a situation that has worked pretty darn well to serve our clients, where the small group population, we've got seven regions in the state. Insurance is about spreading risk over large groups of people. I'd like to see the pooling even spread further, but at least within the seven regions we work in, the small group rating system has worked pretty darn well. So what I'd like to see is a situation where we work towards the goal of continuing what went on there. This legislation to move the small group to 100 has been around since 2010. This isn't something we just found out about yesterday. I was excited about the fact that when we were originally looking at this thing that we're going to get the pools to expand. We don't have a lot of groups out in Eastern Oregon that are 50 to 100, but we have some. And that would give us a chance to expand the pool again. The issue is that if we go into a situation with the transitional plans where you create a structure where good groups with good experience are hung on to and kept outside those pools, guess what happens to the groups that have the negative experience? They end up dropping into the pool. So guess what happens to my other clients who've already been getting their insurance through those small group pools? So that's part of the issue that I have a very real concern about. You know, we've heard testimony on how the mechanics of transitional plans, you know, can skew the risk pools. I encourage everybody here to look at what's gone on in the individual market in 14 and looks like it's going to go on in 15, in that what we did with the transitional plans, I think, had a dramatic impact on the folks that are in those individual pools. And I don't know if anybody's been looking at what kind of rate increases proposed are being filed in those individual plans right now, but it isn't pretty. I mean, we used to have a situation where everybody had to go through health statement qualification to get those plans. Now everybody got to drop in. But if you take part of the healthy pool and keep them out of there, guess what the impact is for the other people within the plans? As a certified insurance counselor, I appreciate the state stepping in and providing some relief to the chaos that was created by the failure of Cover Oregon. I think that the current environment, you know, no longer benefits from these transitional plans that we're looking at. I would like to see all of the transitional plans go away and let the free market begin to work. Get these people into a situation where we spread that risk by region and give them the best potential cost spread over the largest number of people within these pools. I have worked with carriers for a long time. I'm not here to knock insurance carriers, but their folks' primary goal in life is to maximize profit and minimize risk. I mean, that's what insurance companies do, regardless of what type of an insurance company there is. If transitional plans are permitted to continue, the carriers selling those plans have the potential, again, like I mentioned a few minutes ago, to price the plans for those groups that have good experience. And by the way, on a group of 100 or less, they don't get experience reports from the carriers. They don't know what their own experience is. You got to get 100 plus before these carriers provide you that kind of information. And I don't know what's happened in self-insurance recently. We've done a number of self-insured groups ourselves in the years over in Eastern Oregon. We don't have a lot of large companies, but I've never done self-insurance for a group with less than 100 employees, and most of them have been 150 to up 200, 300 employees. So maybe there's a shift coming in that realm. But I don't personally, at least in my region, I don't see a threat to self-insurance being a big part of what's going on here. I'm concerned that we allow healthy, low utilization groups to go and stay in a plan that keeps them out of the pool, and you allow sick or challenged health groups that with a lot of claims drop into the pools, and it creates a really potentially negative impact for all of us. You take an example. Let's say we got a 60 life group, okay? And their rate's 2.25 a month right now. I mean, maybe that's a real low number. And, you know, with dropping into the pool, the rate goes to $300, okay? The carrier's now got a decision to make. Okay, this group's making us money. We can price them at $295 or $290, and we can keep them out of the small group pool because there's an incentive to do that. They're still getting a fairly substantial rate increase. But what is the challenge then for the other people that are left in the pool when the groups that they look at and say, oh, no, we're going to charge that group $350 or $400 a month because we don't want them in here anymore, and they get pushed over into the small group pool with my existing 120 groups or so that we work with in the small group pool in Oregon, with higher rates because of higher utilization that drops into that pool. I personally believe that transitional plans are not benefiting the consumer. We need to get to a point where we allow the market to free itself up. Transitional plans are going to, in my estimation, hurt this segment of what you call a large group market. It really hasn't been called the large group market in the last 30 years. It's been called the HIPAA pool, the 50 to 100 realm out there. And that I think the biggest benefactor from this may be the carrier that takes and decides how to price these groups based upon what's going on in that potential group's experience, which they probably don't even have information on themselves because I have never had the carriers provide that information to us in that segment of the group size. I don't know what else I have to add. As a insurance counselor and a certified financial planner, I'm a numbers guy. I love my clients. I love to help them. I am afraid that we're going to reach a point if we don't get a fix on this. The problem is I don't care how good a health care system we have. If you can't afford to access it anymore, it just doesn't matter. And the average income for our folks out in our part of the state is lower than it is over here in this side of the state. And our health insurance rates in many cases have been higher. That isn't a great dynamic to have to work with. I would just like to see the transitional plans personally in all sizes, individual and group, go away and let the market pull itself and come back to the stability that we saw when we went through the small group reform back in the mid-1990s.
Great. Thank you so much.
Thank you for your consideration.
Betsy.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Betsy Earls representing Associated Oregon Industries, and I'm appearing before you today in support of House Bill 2466 with the inclusion of the Dash 6 amendments. As I think you've heard several times already, 2466 clarifies the state's ability to allow employers with 51 to 100 employees to renew as large groups beyond next January. And we're concerned that other amendments that might restrict the provisions that allow such renewals would disrupt coverage to that's currently provided by employers of this particular in this particular size group. If forced out of large group coverage, there would be few options for employers. In particular, small group products would be forced into small group products with dramatically higher premiums, and I think you've already heard how much that would cost. The other alternative, which is not any more appealing for groups of that size, is self-insurance, and I think in the long run, that really is not a great option for those sort of mid-sized companies that don't have a huge critical mass of employees to cover. The Dash 6 amendments would let employers of this size keep their current coverage in place for as long as the federal government allows, and we urge your support.
Thank you very much. Questions for this group? Thank you so much, and have a safe trip back.
Thank you.
All right, we have four more. DJ Vogt, Jesse O'Brien, Doug Reeds, and Don, is it Border or?
Bonder.
Will you get us there? Did I steal your seat?
Proceed.
No, you're called first.
Chair Monica Anderson, members of the committee, DJ Vogt with the Oregon Business Association. I stand here before you to support House Bill 2466 with the Dash A6 amendments. My comments will sound very similar to Betsy's, but I will reiterate the emphasis that we believe this will provide stability to consumers who are served by that segment of plans today, particularly during the next wave of the ACA implementations. We would oppose any proposal that restricts or eliminates these transitional plans that are allowed by the bill. We think that letting these employers keep their plans until the federal government straightens out their rulemaking would be the prudent thing to do for the state. And again, we fear that some employers would lose their coverage, some will have fewer coverage options, and some would have very serious premium increases if these transitional plans aren't allowed to move forward. So that summarizes our comments. And
thank you so much.
Senator Monis Anderson, committee members, my name is Dawn Bonder. I'm CEO of Health Republic Insurance Company. Health Republic is a 501c29 consumer-operated and oriented plan, also known as a co-op. We, by law, are governed by our members, and all of our profits and or surplus must be used for our member benefit. That can be done in three ways: lower premiums, greater benefits, or quality improvement. Our mission is to offer high-quality, affordable health insurance to individuals and employers throughout Oregon. And it's our mission that brings me before you today. I have submitted some written testimony, which I'm sure will provide you with some insomnia relief. But I'll try to make this quick and really address some of the points that were made in the prior testimony that I think need to have some further clarification. I'd like to start with Commissioner Calley's comments, one being that businesses need time to adjust. As I believe another speaker has said, this law was passed in 2010. It is now 2015. The law built in a six-year time period before this small group transition took place in order to give businesses time to mentally and planning-wise adjust. We don't need any more time to adjust. It's just kicking the can down the road. Second of all, there's been a lot of talk about the chance for self-insurance. So the very Academy of Actuaries paper that Mr. Holt referred to also highlights the danger of allowing for transitional plans in the 51 to 100 market segment due to the option of the carriers to raise rates at their own behest and basically cherry pick those groups they want to keep and raise rates to ensure those they don't want to keep can move into the small group market. So I'd be happy to actually send you a copy of that paper, because I think it is important to note that they note that as a risk just as much as the potential for self-insurance. Here in Oregon, I think we really have to look at what the cost to self-insure would be. And if the losses by carriers in 2014 and the Q1 losses by carriers for 2015 aren't enough to make these employers go running from self-insurance, I'm sure the numbers, when they actually pencil out what it is to bear the risk themselves for their employees' health care, pharmaceutical, and hospital costs, they're going to find that the small group market, while maybe a tad more expensive than what they were paying in the small in the large group market, is still going to be infinitely more affordable and more feasible than self-insurance. And even if they decided to self-insure, what would change their decision in 2017? They're going to have the same transition into the small market where the rates ostensibly will be higher than what they're paying. So the fear of self-insurance does not diminish just by putting it off a year. It just once again kicks the can down the road. The worst possible outcome of this is all small businesses will see rate increases. And I think it's really interesting that we have AOI and OBA submitting testimony in favor of transitional plans. I think it would be interesting to look at the percentage of members of AOI and OBA who are actually in that category of 51 to 100, or better yet, 1 to 50 employees. I think you've also received testimony from the Main Street Alliance, which actually represent small businesses, saying that they fear the rate hikes that small businesses will see if transitional plans are permitted to persist in the marketplace. And Mr. Stratton made an excellent point, which I want to reiterate. There may be a big differential between some employer groups in the large group market today, those very healthy young groups, and what their community rated small rates would be if they moved into that small group market. But transitional plans removes competition in the large group market for those groups. All the insurance carrier has to do is look at the publicly available small group prices, figure out what that group will pay if they move into the small group, because let's face it, they have all the information necessary to do that, and price those plans just enough below to ensure that they'll stay with the transitional plan. So those employers we're seeking to protect, they're going to see large rate increases regardless. Make no doubt about it. Except they're going to have no other choice but to stay with that carrier at that rate or pay more in the small group market. It is really unnecessary for this state to continue to have transitional plans. Yes, some states in the country are moving forward with those, but let's look at which states they are and what other policies align with Oregon's. I'm guessing we won't find many. Additionally, I think it's important to look at the experience that Washington has had with their individual market. Our individual market in Oregon for 2014 and Q1 of 2015 is deplorable. And we're seeing rate increases through the roof in order to compensate for the cost of care of that risk pool. Washington has pretty stable individual rates, which is interesting because they don't have any transitional plans. So while we don't have enough data to say that transitional plans is the only factor causing these rate increase requests, I think we'd really, really be, you know, not doing our jobs, both you as legislators and us as a community, to not think carefully about the impact of transitional plans. I think that if the federal government wanted transitional plans, they would have mandated it. However, they've given options to states. And there's no reason Oregon needs to take that option. We are protecting no one except the carriers who currently have these transitional plans and giving them the opportunity to turn consumer benefit into profit. And along those lines, we're keeping hundreds of groups, probably thousands of groups and tens of thousands of people out of the market and hurting new entrants, of which this state has quite a few. And I believe you've gotten testimony from a number of them about the impacts that this will have. So I think I've covered, there's one other point I'd like to make. Currently, the way the A6 amendment is drafted, it is tied to federal law, which today only allows for transitional plans through, I believe it's the end of September 2017. However, if the feds decide to extend that permission for transitional plans beyond that date, this bill would then automatically extend it as well, because this bill is tied to a 2020 date that is not set. It is a time when they will come back to consider if any of this should even be granted further permission to exist. So the way the amendment is currently drafted, a change in federal law would allow this state to have transitional plans to carry on into the next decade. And that is way too long for us to be dealing with the instability and uncertainty that the bifurcation of risk pools and crossing of risk pools and adverse selection caused by cherry picking. It is very disruptive and no more disruptive than any of the other possible opportunities from killing transitional plans. Thank you for the opportunity to explain.
Chair Monis-Anderson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jesse O'Brien. I'm the healthcare advocate with OSPIRG, the Oregon State Public Interest Research Group. I want to be as clear as possible about our position on this bill. We have no objection to the vast majority of what's in the bill. We have no particular position on the merits of whether the small group market should expand from 50 to 100. And in fact, we have no objection to the idea, in principle, to the idea of having a transition for the small group market into the expanded version that the ACA lays out. However, I do have some serious concerns about the way that transition will be handled in the A6 amendment, as a number of people before me have suggested. I think there's a very real concern about systematic adverse selection against the existing small group market. My understanding is that DCBS has expressed an intent to address this issue by including a provision in the amendments to give them rulemaking authority to subject the transitional plans to rate review if necessary to prevent this sort of adverse selection. We aren't necessarily in opposition to that approach, but I would be far more comfortable if there was some more advanced guidance about how that would work and that we could really be assured that the small group market isn't going to suffer large rate increases as a result of our attempt to transition into the larger risk pool. I would also point out that we actually supported the individual transitional plans way back in 2014 because it was for individuals, because we did not have a functional exchange at the time, and there was no way for those individuals to access tax credits. There were really it was really the best of a set of bad options. I do not think that we are in that position today. I do not think that failing to extend these transitional plans would lead to the kind of loss of coverage that not having transitional plans in 2014 would have. I hope we can have a conversation that actually leads to a successful transition for Oregon's small group market, as opposed to just moving this conversation down the line a couple of years in a way that doesn't change the underlying market dynamics, and we wind up talking about the disruption of the small group expansion for years to come. I think we need to figure out how to make this transition work for Oregon businesses and their employees, and the sooner the better. Thank you so much, Jesse.
All right. Seeing no questions, let's have Doug Reeds, and I don't think there's anyone else.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I know we're running way over time, so I'll make a couple quick points. I know I've spoken to most of you. I just want to make 2 points. I'm here on behalf of Doug Riggs, I'm here on behalf of Oregon's Health Co-op, and also work with Health Republic. We certainly have worked on health transition and health reform for many years. So my 2 points are these two. Number one, I'd like to echo Mr. Stanton's testimony on the impact on rural Oregon. I grew up in Redmond, Oregon. The bulk of the jobs in Central Oregon, Eastern Oregon are created by small businesses. Rural Oregon tends to have higher cost for many of the health insurance products and the health insurance pools. There's a reason for that. The miles driven, chronic conditions, the type of workplace that the environment may encounter. And so I think what this does from that perspective is to lead to the potential that those prices could go up on those plans in rural Oregon. So that's number one concern. And I think Mr. Stanton did a very good job. The second is I think all the testimony today kind of indicated what one of our major points is, which is this is a very major policy decision. So regardless of whether or not you think it's a good decision or a bad decision, it came to the committee, came to the House committee on the very last day of the hearing. We have tried to have conversations with the OID for the last 2 months on this. We have finally sat down with OID on Friday, and this has major implications on the health insurance market for you and for your constituents. So we think this deserves far more than inclusion in a housekeeping bill. We think that the OID should go back to the drawing board and come back during the September hearings and have a fuller discussion on this. If something needs to be done, let's discuss it next February. But it's awfully late at 5:10 on one of the last days of your hearing to really get a grip and a handle on this very difficult issue. And I think the testimony indicates that. So we would very strongly support the A7s. That gives us an opportunity to come back at a later point in time, have a much more thorough discussion of this, and figure out what's best for Oregon's businesses and consumers. Thank you.
Questions? I'd like to ask Laura a question regarding one of the issues which Mr. Stanton brought up on just getting rid of the transitional plans and letting the market determine. I know I've had it explained to me, but I'd like it on the record on your point of view on just getting rid of transitional plans right now.
Chair Monica Sanderson, I'd be happy to address that. And I want to clarify a little bit, too, of what I heard earlier. So transitional plans for individual market plans, which aren't really the issue here, but those are ending at the end of this year, so they won't be continuing. And actually, it was a relatively small portion of the population who was on those plans in 2015. But going forward, right now we have Senate Bill 1582, which was passed in the short session in 2014, actually directly, not without granting rulemaking authority, directly told insurance companies that if they wanted to offer transitional plans that they could. And so a number of insurers, the majority in the small group market, did offer those plans. And at the end of 2014, more than 110,000 of the nearly 170,000 small group customers were still on a transitional plan. So we're talking about a pretty significant portion of the small group market. You know, one of the reasons that we had small group transitional plans, I know it was highlighted that there were some difficulties with the exchange when it first opened in before 2014. But, you know, we've got a similar issue where we're kind of still working on getting SHOP up and running in mid-2016. And so transitional plans have been kind of a measure to allow small groups to have some stability and to have some predictability while they planned. and as they kind of looked forward to, you know, investigating the potential benefits of using a shop exchange and exploring the ACA compliant plan options. So our main concern is that there be consistency. Right now, we're actually in the middle of rate review, and so insurance companies have submitted rates to us in the small group market, assuming that transitional plans are going to continue, because that's the direction that we've given via the authority that was provided to us in Senate Bill 1582 to extend that. So we'd have concerns about treating the 1 to 50 groups differently from the 51 to 100 groups. It's certainly going to be the legislature's call as to, you know, what weigh the risks. And I understand, I mean, there are risks and concerns on both sides that I think are valid. But, you know, we have gone down this path. We have, you know, made decisions collectively to allow the transitional plans through that October 2016 date. I think it would be helpful to continue to have that stability of, allowing that to continue as we've stated, as the rates have been filed at this point, and to give us that time that we need to discuss, consider ways that we could potentially mitigate that transition when it does occur.
And you said 110,000?
Yeah, 110,000, pardon me, Chair Miles Anderson, 110,000 or so of the 170,000 small group members that we had at the end of 2014.
Thank you so much. All right.
Last question, Madam Chair. So to clarify, in Dawn's testimony, she said that the bill doesn't actually say October 2016. It says it ties it to the federal law. So if the federal law changes, our compliance would change too. Do you agree with that?
Chair Modis Anderson, Senator Shields, so yes, the bill does just point to federal guidance. And so right now, that's pretty clear at October 1, 2016. And our intent is not to go beyond that. There was a 2020 date that was referred to. And I think that actually refers to an automatic repeal of the transitional plan piece. But it does require us to come back and talk to the legislature before making any change to extend that, and long before 2020. I think it's a 2017 or a 2018 date. But at this point, I mean, it's our intent not to go beyond that 2016. We also want to make this transition happen. We just want to do it in a way that's consistent and that's well planned.
Great. All right, any other questions? All right, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2466. And is it an A version? Yeah, A. And then open a work session on House Bill 2466A.
Madam Chair, I move to adopt the -A3 amendment into House Bill 2466A.
Senator Cruz moves to adopt the A3 amendment. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? It's adopted.
Madam Chair, I move to adopt the A6 amendments into House Bill 2466A.
Senator Cruz moves to adopt the A6s into House Bill 2466. Is there any opposition? It's adopted.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2466A as amended by the -A3 and -A6 amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 2466 as adopted with the A3s and the A6s to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Senator Shields.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm very conflicted on this bill. And when we expanded the small group number from 25 to 50, there were some winners and losers in that move. And we heard from the losers.
That's right.
quite a bit. And yet I'm very... also very concerned about just kind of the different playing field of the new players in the market, the co-ops versus the more established carriers. I think where I will come down is to support it with taking Commissioner Cowley at her word that we're going to make this transition no later than October of 2016. And I think that would certainly be my legislative intent, and I hope that should federal law change, that you would stick to what you presented in this committee.
Any other discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Motion carries. And who would like to carry this bill?
I'll take it if you want my turn. I don't care. Somebody else wants it, they can have it. But I'll take it if you don't have another option.
Oh, that's all right. Senator Steiner Hayward has volunteered.
And she was excited about it.
And she was very excited about it. Okay. So I will close the work session on House Bill 2466. And make sure that we indicate that we're carrying over 2638 and 2300. That we're adjourned. And 2300.